This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello and welcome to Talking Turkey. I'm your host, Ahval editor David Lepeska, and with me today is a returning guest, Stephen A. Cook, prominent Turkey watcher and senior fellow for the Middle East and North Africa at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thanks so much for joining us, Stephen.
It's great to be back, David.
Before we get to Turkey in the news, I thought I might ask about your self-quarantining experience, which appears to have given you a new appreciation for your home and surroundings. You tweeted yesterday that for the first time in a decade, you were able to accept your decision to move out of the city and into the suburbs. I'm guessing that's because the inherent social distancing out there means you feel your family is more safe?
Yeah, I mean, it's sad to say that these kinds of things occur to you. My wife and I, both of us grew up in the suburbs, but had been living in cities since we graduated from college. And I remember when we first moved into our home a little more than a decade ago, we looked at each other and we said, okay, as soon as the kids are off to college, we'll move back to an urban area. And I have to say, you know, in looking at just pictures from New York City, from D.C., from other places, it's just a lot easier to socially distant even in the close into Washington, D.C. suburbs. I've done a lot of gardening in my backyard and no one's within 6 feet of me other than my immediate family. So it gives a certain peace of mind when we know that the only defense against this right now is to remain physically apart from each other. And also just, you know, the physical environment. Before we lived in suburban Maryland, we lived in New York City, and we lived in a large apartment building in Manhattan, and there were thousands of people there. Just the city urban environments don't make it easy to physically distance yourself from others. And then think about, you know, megalopolises like Istanbul or Cairo or Lagos and all these places around the world that have just huge populations. It's just going to be a real challenge for people. So on my little island here in suburban Maryland, just north of the infamous Beltway, I was momentarily feeling a little bit better about, at least from a personal perspective, my family situation.
Right. I'm with a friend at a cabin in remote New Mexico, and I don't have to do any distancing because there's nobody to distance from, but I am starting to feel anxious about returning to civilization soon. You know, it sounds like it's, yeah, fraught, it being in any sort of building or tight neighborhood. Yeah.
Right. I have friends who live in New York City who the buildings have put in place. No one other than residents are permitted in the building. So, you know, there's the best that you can do kind of measures in these environments. I mean, one of the theories that Italy has experienced such a kind of unbelievable, mind-boggling upward trajectory in both infections as well as deaths is not only the older population, but the population density in Italy. That's an advantage that the United States has. We have a lot of space and we're a lot of people that are spread out, unlike Milan or just in general Lombardy.
Sure. I hear some twisting sound. Are you doing something with?
No.
There's some. Do you hear that?
No.
Oh shoot! I wonder what that is. Okay, maybe it'll go away. Okay, we are speaking on Monday, March 23rd. 12 days, I believe, since Turkey's first confirmed coronavirus case. As of Sunday, yesterday, Turkey is at more than 1,200 confirmed cases and more than 30 deaths, with cases expected to spike with the arrival overnight of some 2 million rapid test kits from China. So after steering clear of the virus for weeks, Turkey now appears to be in the early stages of a mass outbreak. More than 300 people have been detained for corona-related social media posts, and the lira today, Monday, this morning, fell to an 18-month low of 6.6 to the dollar. In a piece for Foreign Policy last week, you pointed to widespread incompetence and complacency across the Middle East, arguing that the disdain leaders like President Erdogan have for their societies robs these countries of social cohesion and compounds crises like the coronavirus pandemic. You also pointed out that Erdogan, who in normal times seems to deliver a speech almost every day, suddenly fell silent when coronavirus appeared in Turkey. I guess then you would argue that Turkey's coronavirus outbreak was not inevitable, but largely the result of a sluggish response from the government?
Well, what I would say is this, is coronavirus knows no boundaries. It knows no politics. It has affected liberal democracies, has affected authoritarian systems, the like. And there have been varying degrees of effectiveness of responses. What I was trying to get at was that my concern that countries in the Middle East were particularly acute were vulnerable in ways that I think other countries may not be. The one is in the Middle East, you have a short supply of leaders who are honest brokers, who are willing to tell the truth or willing to absorb the inevitable criticism from their opponents or a free media. And that also these very same leaders have spent years undermining, attacking, arresting, suppressing civil society, which can help absorb the blow of a pandemic like coronavirus and the associated illness COVID-19. That puts countries at a disadvantage. And one of the things that you pointed out in your intro is that it now seems, you know, you said something along the lines is that Turkey seems to have avoided it. I'm not entirely clear that Turkey had avoided it up until the trickle of cases that were being reported. What people inside Turkey tell me is that there's been there was a significant increase in pneumonia-related cases earlier on, that the government has been trying to suppress diagnoses. That's not, to me, suggests that you've had an outbreak longer than the government is reporting. Now, the government has taken some, I think, good steps. You know, they've shut down travel. They are enforcing a curfew for people who are over 65. You know, businesses are being asked to shut down. Bureaucracy is now working remote. Those are all good things. And those are the things that global public health officials have recommended. But I think that like other countries, Turkey's been somewhat slow, and it does have these two problems. One, a leadership that wants to hear the best possible news, doesn't take well to criticism, and a civil society that has been capped. And I'm afraid it's going to be a big problem. As you point out, the numbers are now really starting to accelerate in Turkey and, in fact, all over the world.
Erdogan's Justice and Development Party, or AKP, has been in power for nearly 18 years, and one of its most widely praised achievements is revolutionizing Turkey's healthcare system, which has included better emergency care, universal access, and significantly reduced child mortality. Yet now it appears to be falling short in the face of this pandemic. The Turkish Medical Association has warned that the number of cases is significantly higher than those announced by the health ministry. Turkish authorities have not revealed the locations of infections or deaths, and detained journalists who attempted to do so. Has the past fortnight revealed Turkey's much praised healthcare system to be a house of cards, or is it more about government mismanagement?
Well, I don't think it's a house of cards. I think the AKP certainly deserves credit for expanding healthcare, declining infant mortality rates. The development of the country over the course of the last two decades has been good, and healthcare is certainly a bright spot. No matter what the healthcare system is in a country, it is the coronavirus challenge is making it very, very hard for systems to catch up and try to beat this thing back. Of course, you have other countries like South Korea, United Arab Emirates, Singapore, Taiwan that have done a much, much better job at this. But still, it remains a global challenge no matter what the model is. I think what's compromising Turkey's response, and one of the things that the Turkish Medical Association is pointing out, is that there has been, like in other places, an official effort to push down numbers, to not reveal the true extent of the problem, which is what everything that global health experts tell you not to do. And then, again, the government revealing its hand, once again, by arresting journalists over reporting information about coronavirus and how it might affect Turkish society. I think this speaks to one of the themes that I tried to highlight in this foreign policy piece. I'll point out that there was a fair number of Turks who attacked me on social media for this. I suspect that had I been in Turkey, I would have been arrested for it.
Yeah, a few days ago, you shared an article on Twitter about how Egypt censors were shifting into high gear over coronavirus coverage. As you say, those of us who've been reading the news in recent days have repeatedly been told that clear, accurate, and science-based information is crucial to keeping people informed and halting the spread of coronavirus. To what extent do you think the information that's coming out of Turkish official sources and government outlets has been manipulated and twisted? And do Turkish citizens trust their government and its mouthpieces today?
It's really hard to tell whether Turkish citizens trust their government. If you're reading it from the outside, you know, the health minister was lauded as a hero just a week ago by many people. But it seems clear as this crisis expands in Turkey, it's going to be harder and harder for health officials and for President Erdogan to maintain this facade that it has always been under control and it's going to be under control, and that Turkey somehow is uniquely set up in a way that it was going to avoid a global pandemic, which was something that you were actually hearing. When the first case was revealed, I said, oh, this was, you know, and this has been the knee-jerk reaction among other leaders, including President Trump, which is that this was something of outsiders. This was a function of people who had traveled to Turkey, and it was not something that could have been prevented, et cetera. I don't think it could have been prevented. So this is an enormous test for governments, and I think that the fact that the Chinese are at least reporting that they haven't seen any new cases internally over 5 days is increasing the authoritarian temptation among governments. And I think people, to be honest with you, I think people are look at that and say, okay, we'll do that for our health. You notice that in Italy, the head of the Chinese Red Cross came and said, look, this sort of relaxed shutdown isn't going to work. You need to take drastic, draconian measures. And I think you're going to start seeing publics who want that. And that plays well in to the strengths of authoritarians who can lock their countries down with the use of force, essentially.
Speaking of more drastic measures, many in Turkey have called for the release of thousands of prisoners who could face health risks in prison. The government has yet to take this step, but after speaking with scientific advisors, the health minister is expected to announce new precautionary measures at a press conference tonight. On Twitter, just before we started talking, I saw that you asked who would hold Turkey's leaders responsible if some of those politicians, journalists, and activists who have been unjustly placed in Turkey's prison started dying. So I guess that means you see that as a serious risk.
Well, all of the reputable reporting has suggested that Turkey's prisons could be a horrific petri dish of coronavirus. And we know that there are thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people who have been imprisoned on questionable charges that they are followers of Fethullah Gulen and thus are terrorists. Some initial reporting was that, you know, hardened criminals would be released, drug dealers, murderers, others would be released. But these people in prison on terrorism charges, including activists and so on and so forth, would not be released. That is, I think, a recipe for disaster. And people who, again, who in jail for purely political reasons for thought crimes. Yeah, it's the large population of people in Turkish prisons who are there for political reasons is a major, major challenge for activists and those who are concerned about their well-being, because it looks like if the Turkish government does anything, it's going to leave them there.
Over the weekend, Turkey issued a curfew for people over 65 who are now supposed to stay indoors, barring an emergency. Some pointed out on Twitter that Erdogan is 66 and thus must now rule while isolated in his massive palace. More seriously, what do you think of the steps Turkey has taken in the past few days? Erdogan has been urging people to stay home. The government raided face mask producing companies this morning to stop any stockpiling. Do you think Turkey can still right the ship and begin to flatten the curve, or is it too late?
Well, look, I think if you're going to socially distance, you definitely want to do it in the Aksaray. I mean, this is a place where you can really get away from people. So I think Erdogan has put himself in a good situation to socially distance and avoid potentially contracting COVID-19. I do think, and I have been following carefully the steps that Turkey has taken, and I think that after a period of time, which, again, the Turks are not, I'm not singling them out, the Turks are not alone in this. A certain amount of complacency, a certain amount of blaming the other, a certain amount of silence, a certain amount of nationalist bravado, I think the Turks are now on board and understand what they need to do. They've cut flights to more countries. They are taking the right steps in order to get medical staff the protective equipment they need. They are trying everything possible to keep people away from each other, including this curfew on people who are 65 years and older. Hopefully for Turkey, Turks will comply with this. Hopefully for Turkey, these companies that do produce medical protective equipment will continue to produce it and even ramp up production. Look, when I read the story today about the Turkish government saying that it was going to seize companies unless they supplied those N95 masks to medical workers, as an American, and we know we're facing a tremendous shortage here in this country over protective equipment, I was hoping that my government would take appropriate action to ensure that our frontline medical workers get that kind of protection. So yeah, I think Turkey is doing the right things. I think like a lot of other governments, they were slow. And the concern is that as there is an explosion of cases, it'll be that much more difficult to manage the situation, if only because there was this complacency and a certain amount of denial and a certain amount of nationalist bravado that came with the discovery of the first cases.
Let's shift to Syria and Idlib province, where some 2 to 3 million displaced people remain squeezed between Turkish troops and their affiliated rebels and the Russia-backed forces of Syrian President Bashar Assad. Russia and Turkey have now held 2 joint patrols, and both have been cut short, apparently for security concerns. Should we read something bigger into this? Is Assad planning to resume his offensive, as reported by Syrian state media last week?
Well, I would never count Bashar al-Assad out in his desire to reestablish control over the entirety of the country and declare a certain victory. I think that the Turkish military operations, and in fact, I wrote about it, in which the Turks demonstrated their proficiency as the second largest army in military in NATO, I think that that gave the Turks a little bit more. It's not Corona, just a cough because I swallowed incorrectly. That the Turks have given themselves a lot more credibility as a player and some more negotiating leverage with the Russians. The problem is, they were able to get this ceasefire and this new agreement, which was basically the status quo ante, but if patrols are being cut short for security reasons, which is what the Russians are saying, would suggest that hostilities may be imminent once again, which is a huge problem on top of, it was a huge problem to begin with, but a huge problem on top of this pandemic. It is definitely a cause for worry. But it's more of a localized concern. Of course, the people of Idlib will suffer. of course, this is something that none of the actors in this really cared that much about. Although I would say that, again, you know, Turkey, which takes a lot of criticism, including from me, was able to do a lot of damage in a short period of time to Assad's forces, which gave a respite to, at least for a short period of time, from the perils of violence from the people in Idlib. Now they're confronting a whole host of other challenges.
Yeah, Erdogan spoke to the leaders of Germany, France, and Great Britain last week and reportedly made little progress on any agreement for Idlib and the refugees. After the Turkey-Russia ceasefire deal for Idlib early this month, you wrote, as you pointed out, you wrote for Foreign Policy that Syria is Turkey's problem, not America's, essentially defending the U.S. and Europe for disengaging and not coming to Turkey's aid in Idlib and arguing that Turkey was doing just fine on its own, at least militarily. At the end of the piece, though, you said that in the longer term, Ankara would likely face the potential crisis of caring for millions of refugees whose presence could prove destabilizing in Turkey. But I was wondering, couldn't their presence prove just as destabilizing for Europe? And shouldn't that potentially be driving greater European aid and engagement?
It should be. And let me just underline the fact that I said it was really the United States' problem. More because I'm sure that there's much that the United States can do in addition to that, or that there's any political will to do in Syria here in the United States. And that the fact that the Turks were demonstrating that they could undertake a military operation effectively, forcing the Russians to stand by, forcing a new negotiation, would suggest to me that, you know, the Turks do have power to wield on their own that can produce results. And that's what I meant by when I said, you know, look, the Turks seem to be doing fine on their own. Now, on this question of refugees, of course, everybody would like for everybody, including the Europeans, to do more on this situation. The unfortunate fact is that it is refugees have created all kinds of political distortions in Europe that are worrying given Europe's history and something that we would not want to repeat. Now, there have been neo-Nazi and far-right parties in Europe for a very, very long time, but they seem to have gotten a lot out of the fact that there are refugees in Europe. That's not to say that Turkey's politics haven't been distorted, and we have to worry about the instability of Turkey as well. But that is the particular concern when it comes to Europe is fueling the rise of far-right and neo-Nazi parties. And, of course, the stability of Europe, the prosperity of Europe, democracy in Europe is a core strategic interest of the United States. There was an agreement on refugees between Turkey and Europe, and then the Turks decided to weaponize refugees and encourage not refugees from Idlib, but refugees already in the country to try to cross the border, creating really ugly and terrible scenes. And the Greeks have much to answer for, and the Europeans have much to answer on this. I'm afraid there isn't a very good answer at this point. As you point out, President Erdogan spoke with major European leaders and got nowhere on this issue, and we're at loggerheads. This may be one of those things that we look back on in history and say, these were short-sighted decisions by people that made situations worse and that led to further instability, which was precisely what they were trying to avoid in the first place.
Mm. Last Thursday, the aid group Syria Campaign said that it was just a matter of time before coronavirus reached the masses of displaced people in Idlib, which has only something like 60 hospital beds after Russian and Syrian targeting of healthcare facilities. Yesterday, Syria reported its first coronavirus case, so it seems like a disastrous Idlib outbreak could be close at hand. It sounds, though, like you think everybody is too busy right now with their own domestic crisis to step in and take some action on this.
I have to say in response to this question is look out for my next foreign policy column, which is precisely on this. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a biodefense expert. I'm not a virologist. I'm not an infectious disease expert. I'm not a global public health expert. I basically have a number of ideas when it comes to the coronavirus pandemic, and one was the previous piece about just in general about governments and civil society and dealing with pandemic. And then I've been watching this Idlib thing, and it seems to be like an outbreak there can increase the problems and challenges to Turkey, to Europe, to Iran, to Syria itself exponentially. It is going to be an issue that should deserve significant global attention that won't get it.
Is there any way to change that? Is there any way to get it the attention it deserves, or is it just inevitable at this point?
Well, I think an outbreak is probably inevitable. The question is which global leader or potential global leader is willing to step in and organize a global response to this. One of the things that's been upsetting about watching all of this unfold is that instead of the United States and China putting aside their differences, putting aside the sniping over where this virus came from and who was more incompetent than whom, you'd like to see the United States, China, South Korea, Japan, and others that have handled this relatively well to marshal global resources in order to fight this pandemic, whether it's in Lombardy or in Idlib. That would be the appropriate thing to do. And as you point out, the Chinese delivered millions of test kits to Turkey. That's a good thing. I think that would be a good thing if China did that in partnership with other major powers that have the capacity to do it. But of course, look, here in the United States, as you well know, we are floundering and foundering in our own response because of complacency, because of incompetence, and because of nationalist bravado.
Finally, one last question on Turkish politics. An interesting coincidence, after months of delays, former deputy prime minister and AKP co-founder Ali Babacan finally launched his political party, the DEVA party, meaning Remedy.
Remedy.
The same day that Turkey announced its first coronavirus case. The party positions itself as West-friendly and an advocate of the rule of law and strong democracy. What's your view? Might Babacan be the cure for what's ailing Turkey?
Is he the remedy? It's hard for me to imagine, and maybe that's my problem. Maybe I'm operating with not a good set of assumptions. It's hard for me to imagine that Babacan can garner the kind of following that's going to make a huge difference in Turkish politics. Now, of course, you know, President Erdogan has been vulnerable since the municipal elections, and the economy hasn't done well. And it'll be interesting to see how he responds to the coronavirus pandemic. But it strikes me that Babacan appeals to a very, very small slice of the Turkish electorate. I know the theory is among Turkish analysts is that if you combine Babacan, Davutoğlu, and other opposition parties, you will drain away enough voters from the AKP that will undermine the parliamentary majority. Maybe. We'll have to see. But again, in one of my snarkier moments, I said that Babacan could win Wall Street and hedge fund land. But look, we'll see how this party unfolds and how he tries to appeal to people beyond that kind of rarefied world where the kind of West-friendly, global finance-friendly, rule of law-friendly group in Turkey, especially against the backdrop of a pandemic where people are looking everywhere in these uncertain times for something that they can hang on to. And I think strong leadership and not necessarily democratic leadership is something that's deeply appealing to people. And that's not just in Turkey. I think we're going to see that globally.
Stephen A. Cook of the Council on Foreign Relations, thanks so much for your time and insight. It's been a pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.